Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Lavasser. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my opinion on that investigation and give you contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any leads, you can contact them directly. So if you're interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. That was a lot. I don't have my teleprompter. I don't have anything in front of me. That was just from memory. I think we've done a few of these episodes. Thank you for joining me for part two of Ellen Greenberg. You know, we're gonna get into the episode, but real quickly, this is a little different, I'm sure, for anybody who's watching on YouTube. You can see that the background, a little different. If we go to a wide here, it's not perfect. It is not perfect. I have a lot I want to do. Right now, I don't even have the other light on yet because someone's going to be sitting in that chair in a minute. We actually just did the interview. I'm recording this after the fact. I was going to see how well this interview went with Dr. Priya Banerjee, and I didn't know if it was going to be 15 minutes or 45 minutes. It ended up being an hour and a half. So it's going to be a whole episode by itself. But I wanted to at least put this opening on it and let you guys know that the interview is going to be part two, but we are going to have a part three. I found the whole conversation very enlightening. As I said to you guys in part one, it really, to me, drove home the point of what I believe. And by the end of this episode, you're going to probably understand or know where I'm heading. But I'll let you get there on your own. Overall, let me know what you guys think of the episode. We're going to come back with part three. I know in part one, there were some people who were like, oh, you didn't address this or you didn't address that. As I said in the episode a couple times, we're going to get to it in part three. I'm not going to cover every single detail. There's a lot to this case. I could do 5-6 episodes. That's not what I'm going to do. And yes, technically, this isn't an unsolved case. By the definition of the law, it's a closed case now. But because of the outcry and the pressure that's being put on everyone, I wouldn't be surprised if something happens with it, although I'm not holding my breath. So this was one of those rare circumstances where I felt an obligation because of your guys' request to cover it and give my opinion on it and do what I do, which is research it, but also bring in the people who can give us some insight onto areas where I may not have an expertise. And that's what we did here. So we're going to get into the interview now. Sit back. Digest it, write down your notes, let me know what you guys think, and we'll be back next week for part three. But in the meantime, here is part two with Dr. Priya Banerjee, forensic pathologist, board certified, not just giving her opinion because that's what she believes, but supporting it with actual evidence and laying it out in a way that it can be understood by everyone who's listening or watching. So here is my interview with board certified forensic pathologist, Dr. Priya Banerjee. Okay, so first interview on Detective Perspective on the new set.
Oh, there you go. It's me.
Dr. Priya Banerjee is here with me. And this kind of just happened randomly. It wasn't planned. It didn't come up until I started looking into Ellen and I was going through some different podcasts and YouTube channels and I stumbled on Court TV and I saw your interview.
That's how that happened.
I saw your interview and I remembered that we had spoke at CrimeCon.
That's right.
And you said, hey, Derek, I'm from Rhode Island.
I know. It's like we had to go halfway across the country to meet in real life. We live miles apart.
And we exchanged numbers.
We did.
And then I saw the YouTube video and I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to let her talk about it in her own words. But as I was listening to her, I was sitting there nodding my head going, okay, that makes sense to me. I have to get her on the phone. And I texted you.
Yeah, we did. I was driving back from somewhere.
You were getting a tattoo.
Oh, I was getting my tattoo. That's right. Well, should I put that on air?
That's okay. Tattoos are okay.
Tattoos are good. All right. But nothing to be ashamed about. But yeah, I was driving from Framingham. So it was quite a bit. I was like, oh, I'll get home in a little bit. I think you texted me while I was getting it.
I did.
And then I was like, okay, I'm going to come back and we'll talk. So because I figure it's better to talk than text complicated issues.
Yeah, no, and we did. We had to talk. I don't know. We talked for maybe 30, 45 minutes. Yep. And you broke it all down for me. And as I was listening to you, I'm like, my audience needs to hear this. Because I was leaning a certain way. And it wasn't until I spoke to you that I was like, okay, now I feel better about how I feel about this case. Because what it comes down to is the pathology. But before we get into that, because not everyone here knows, do you want me to go by Dr. Banerjee or Priya?
Priya, I prefer
Priya. I like first names.
Okay, me
so
too.
So Priya is here, and she's not just someone who's coming on because I saw her on YouTube. She is a board-certified forensic pathologist. She's worked over approximately 3,000 autopsies, 170 homicides. She did 11 years in the Rhode Island Medical Examiner's Office.
Correct.
Now you're working privately for Anchor.
Yep, Anchor Forensic Pathology is my company, and I actually started it while I was at Rhode Island sort of to get involved in side work. I had lawyers calling me from because they had worked with me in the past and they were like, oh, you were great. You should do it. And I've been very lucky. It's sort of exponentially opened up new channels for me. And now I'm in private practice.
And so basically there'll be a case, let's just say like an Ellen Greenberg case where Correct. They're looking for a second opinion or they're trying to go over the pathology report with an independent party.
Correct.
They'll fly you out there. You'll be an expert witness and you'll talk about
Right. So there's a lot of things that I do now. It's sort of multidimensional. I still love to teach. So I still mentor young doctors who want to become grow up.
And by the way, what's the university you're at? Little university?
Brown.
Brown University. You guys may have heard of it. Yeah, it's kind of a small little Ivy League school. No big deal.
So
she's teaching them. So put that in perspective.
Yeah. Like this is a very niche profession. Mm-hmm. And so I want people who want to do it to get into it. You know, we need passionate people because it's not you don't do work for the state. As you know, or a city municipality for the money.
No. I talk to these guys all the time about it. They're like, oh, why'd you go private? Yeah. It was a variety of reasons, life and stuff. But you're definitely not in this industry for the
right.
money.
Right. You know, it's interesting because working for myself in the community, I do private autopsies now too. So you're trying to, you know, see what my practice consists of. So I'm teaching a lot. I do private autopsies where families will hire me and say, look, you know, it's a false understanding that every person that dies gets an autopsy at the ME's office.
Yeah.
So you can't, I mean, that's just physically impossible, even in a small state.
Right. There's got to be circumstances that dictate.
That's right. Right. And when grandma dies in bed, you're just not going to get that. Right. As long as, you know, it's not suspicious, then you're not going to get that.
I give you a lot of credit because, and I've talked about it in some episodes, but I have so much respect for pathologists because when it is a case that's suspicious, a lot of the times we're there as detectives.
Yes, of course.
We're there and we're monitoring or observing the autopsy. Not that we're really contributing anything, but we're allowed to be in the room.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And I will tell you.
I used to have a lot of questions for you guys, so it was a very interactive kind of session.
I was the guy behind the glass because, and if you remember in that office, they had the glass there because, candidly, I just couldn't do it.
It's not for everyone, and there's a minority of us. I mean, if you think about it, I think the average number that they quote is around 500 board-certified pathologists in the country. You know, after college, I went to medical school at UPenn in Philadelphia. Another Ivy.
I wasn't going to say it. I'm like, okay. Underachiever for sure over here.
I did med school there, and I did 1 year what I call living people medicine.
Oh,
so
okay.
I wanted to know what it's like to be a doctor. So I did the living people medicine for a year, and then I did 4 years of pathology at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And then I did my fellowship at the state of Maryland. And it's because Hopkins is very research-oriented, very cancer-oriented. And so out of 4 years, 48 months, 1 month was spent at the ME's office. So you can see even when it's a very specific field of pathology, forensics is just this tiny little snippet. There's no way you can become an expert in a month.
No, it's experience.
Yeah,
it's doing
so doing it and having more responsibility. So when you're a fellow, you do the more difficult cases, right? It's like being a trainee in patrol versus becoming a detective, right? Yeah. So you really have more responsibility on your plate.
And obviously the homicide detectives who have done 1,000 cases going to be more equipped than the guy who's only done 100.
That's right.
It's simple math.
Simple math and exposure.
So with pathology, and I've talked about it on both Crime Weekly and Detective Perspective a lot, where obviously it's critical to a case. The pathologist, the autopsy, it's so important. That's right. But I have a love-hate relationship with it. We were talking about it before before we got on camera, and by all means, push back on me. But
something
that I've always said, my phrase is, yes, it's a science, but the interpretation of that science is somewhat subjective. Like
it
basically
is.
What
it
you
is.
Interpret.
Sure.
You're talking about the different signs you see.
Right.
You can, based on the pathologist, they may come to a different conclusion, where this case that we're going to talk about tonight is the poster child
for
that.
So you'll see in my autopsy reports, there's the data section, which are like the observation. The liver is the liver weight is the liver weight.
That's not
a negotiable. Right.
That's what it is.
It's a data set, data point, right? And the autopsy exam, you can almost think of like a set of numbers, right? This is the description. This is the weight. This is the location. Sometimes we even look at it under the microscope, which get more features of it. And then it says opinion. So manner, opinion, this is why so-and-so died and they have cause and manner of death. So you can see that there's the description of what is there, the physical findings, and then there's the interpretation.
Yep.
The interpretation has some nuance to it, and that's really where you might get four or five pathologists in a room that have differing opinions.
We're seeing it here.
Yeah, there can be differing opinions. I think why I'm a very logical person, so I like to lay out things step by step, but to me, anytime I'm doing any case, okay, I just had a deposition last week. Here's the article that supports my, this is a recent article or, this is a very hallmark article that says X, Y, Z, and this is how I got to the conclusion. So I really like to look at the medicine parts of the autopsy, literature, science, and even the investigation, if you will, right? It's not a black box. Yeah. I say that all the time. We have to consider everything. This is how I came to the conclusion.
Well, I like what you did with Ellen when we talked. And we're going to talk about it right now. I know you guys are like, okay, so what does she think? But for me, in some cases, even in this one, you have two pathologists now who have come back and said that this was a suicide.
Correct.
Even the most recent one, Dr. Lucy Simon, came back and said, even though she cited Dr. Sarah Wecht and some other pathologists, Dr. Lee, she comes back and says, nope, it's still a suicide. And in my read on her, it was more about the absence of evidence to support a homicide than the actual evidence itself. And I want you to talk about what you believe in this case, and you've talked about it publicly before.
Yes.
And why you believe it, because the why is what I found so compelling.
Sure. So I just want to put the caveat, this is out of Philly.
Yeah.
But way after my med school days or so, I don't actually know the staff in the ME office. So Dr. Simon, I have no relationship with that. I couldn't pick them off the
street. I wish they would have got someone outside. Does that happen often?
I don't know about the legalities of that because it's usually within the jurisdictional issue. Right.
Because that's what a lot of people are screaming for, is to allow someone who may not have political ties or have some pressure put on them because they're from that community where they can give an outside opinion and not worry about the blowback from it.
And that's true. I mean, you know this and I know this. The work we do always has political
100%.
Impact, right?
Absolutely.
And it has, and if it didn't directly have political impact, the community will have feedback, which will have political impact.
You're eating at the grocery store, you're going shopping at the same place as them, and you get the politicians there, they're from your communities. Anybody who says it's not a part of it, when you're thinking about, okay, the decision in this case that I make is going to affect my kids and my partner.
That's right.
That's a realistic concern. Anybody who says it's not, this isn't the movies.
So you want to laugh. I mean, totally unrelated to this, but now that I've done some media work and people, I get hate emails. Oh, she's stupid.
Never. I've never gotten that.
Oh, so one week I'm on the not so nice list because of whatever I said in a case.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next week I'm like the poster child for saving the day. And I was like, that's funny because you watched me last week at testifying in a separate state and I'm the same person.
Well, there's one case that me and you don't agree on, but we'll talk about it another one.
Okay.
Megan Trussell.
We'll talk about that. But with regards to this case, I think I put the caveat, I'm not at all associated with the office. Right. And I was never asked, you know, there were outside pathologists earlier in the process yeah. that were very famous names. Dr. Yeah. Weck, yep. Dr. Lee.
Rest in peace. No longer with us.
Yeah.
Yep. Wayne Ross.
Wayne Ross. Yep, yep. Yeah. So there were other, I think, four or five experts that were listed in this new cumulative report.
Right.
Not me. So this is completely just my interpretation without any money, fame, you know,
and by
anything.
The way, they all said homicide.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's good to know. All, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Like, Sarawak was basically, I don't think he examined the body. He was looking at the report. But right. there was a lot of things, but the main things were no suicide, no. Mm-hmm. The amount of cases that he's worked where they've stabbed themselves in the back of the neck. Neck,
yeah.
Like, so a lot of those historical data, you talked about it earlier, right. the experiences.
That's right.
Right? How many suicides you've worked where you can look at it and say, yeah, it's possible, but in my profession, I've never seen it or I've seldomly seen it.
Seldomly seen it. And so I brought it up and a lot of people have agreed with me when I've talked to journalists and stuff. They're like, I'm like, think of what we say in layman's terms, stabbed in the back.
You said this on the phone, yeah.
Right? If yeah. To the audience, what does that mean to a layperson, right? This is not a medical opinion. This is just living in society. That means someone screwed you over.
Yep, that's right.
Which means you didn't do that to yourself. Okay, yeah. So if you take that as a non-medical fact and just keep that in the back of your mind, okay? And that doesn't mean so the caveat to this is I've had quite a few suicides that were unbelievable.
Yep. Anybody ever stabbed themselves in the neck?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So this has happened
yes.
before.
Yes. So not in the back of the neck, but definitely on the sides. People have stabbed themselves. I had someone in Rhode Island stab themselves like 90 plus times.
I was talking about this. I've had a case like that
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And I went to the scene and I was just like livid. Like, there's no way this is a suicide. And the police were so complacent I came around and agreed with them like after we went through the... But I mean, my red flag was up.
Yep.
And I was like, there's no
As
way
it should be.
No way you're going to convince me that this is, at least it's going to take a lot of calming down. And I'm pretty excitable. And so you're not going to just off the whim say suicide. It needs to be a lot
like
more.
They did here,
right. It really needs to be examined from different angles, different data shown to me. And so that involved making sure there weren't other entries into the apartment. The apartment hallway had cameras.
That's right.
I did a walkthrough of the scene myself with police. Then I did a separate walkthrough with blood spatter.
Well, there
analysis.
Wasn't cameras in the hallway or outside the apartment door, but there's cameras down in the lobby.
Right,
I wish there was a camera outside the door.
Oh, no, I'm talking about my case, my specific case.
Okay, an
example. Like, what made me, back down, you know? Yep. So the wounds were...
You had evidence to support where they were going.
That's right. But it's a lot to take in. When I looked at this woman at the scene, she was naked, stabbed in very compromising areas, you know? Yeah. We're talking... 90 plus wounds. It was unbelievable.
To clarify, when I said anyone stabbed in the neck in a suicide, you've had someone who's committed suicide who stabbed themselves up to 90 times.
Correct.
But have you ever had someone like Ellen's case where they've stabbed themselves
not in the back.
In the back of the neck?
Not the back.
It just seems so
I've had basically all other regions of the neck.
So
does that make sense?
How many suicides would you say you were?
Oh, a lot. My God.
Hundreds?
Oh, easily. Over 500, yeah.
So 500 cases, never had someone stab them in the manner that Ellen was stabbed.
So they've stabbed themselves all over.
Yeah.
Even in the heart, the belly, the head, the neck, but not in the back where this was very...
It's almost like it doesn't make sense, right? Like it doesn't make sense.
So, you know, that's a segue into it. So just understand that there's cause and manner of death. Okay, so cause of death is not in question here. It is the... And they say 20 stab wounds. We're getting into definitions. I like to call them 20 sharp force injuries.
Yep.
And that means a sharp object caused them. Not everything was so deep that it caused injury. They can be superficial, you know, or deep.
And we'll throw that up on the screen too while you're talking. Okay. That chart that you're
the
talking
chart,
about.
Right.
You start mentioning the letters.
Right.
That'll be on
and
the screen.
And so I want people to keep that in mind. Oh, 20 stab wounds. It's sort of a misuse of the
term.
Some
of them are like 0.5 centimeters.
That's right. So they're very small. They're almost like little pin pricks or, you know, knife pricks.
Yep.
So it's not that they're going to cause a ton of injury.
Yep.
So just think about that. Yes, it's an injury, but it's not a lethal injury. Not 20 lethal injuries were there. Significant still, right? But nonetheless, like I said, it's not the number in isolation. It's not that she's a woman. I've had all these B suicides. So the sharp force injuries, the cause of death is not being debated in her case.
We know how
she
died.
We know it died, yeah.
Blood loss. Right?
Correct. So the totality of blood loss from it.
Yep.
adds to it, but we'll also clarify that. Now, the manner of death, so we're talking, have you had suicide? Suicide is a manner of death, so there's natural, 100% natural, like a disease, okay? And I always like to say that that doesn't make it sad. Kids die with cancer. My mom died of a stroke. Let me tell you, I was pretty darn sad, you know, but no one did anything to her. That was just bad luck, you know, that was how we roll. But there's no external influence, if you will, okay? No drugs, alcohol, anything like that. So accident, we're probably very familiar with that. Car accidents, drug overdoses, unintentional outcome of an action. Suicide is the intentional ending of one's life. And the modality can be anything, right? You can stab yourself, shoot yourself, overdose, hanging. I mean, so again, that those are the causes of death. Yep. Suicide is the manner. Then there's homicide, which is death at the hands of another, or neglect can sometimes even do it. But then there's the fifth one, which is undetermined. And that does come into play here. So undetermined is when you can't decide, despite all the evidence, all the analysis, extra investigation, as a doctor, I cannot best classify the death into one of the first four that I mentioned. And, you know, it looks like this case is a good example where there is differing opinions and different facts are being weighed or given different weights, you know, into sort of sorting out how we're going to classify it.
All right, I know we're in the middle of a fascinating interview, but we're going to take a quick break. The holidays sneak up fast. Every year I say I'll get ahead of gifts, and every year I don't. But this time, I actually found something that makes gift shopping easier and honestly, way more meaningful. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and enjoyable with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. I was just on their website again recently, and it's not the same recycled gifts that you see everywhere else. There are unique, actually thoughtful things people will want to keep, and we know that's not always the case. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the US. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I just saw a personalized whiskey decanter set on there that I might get for my dad, or I might just get it for myself. And I also found a custom adventure book for my daughter. So stuff like that that actually feels personal. That's what I'm looking for. And listen, if you're hard to shop for or you're shopping for someone who already has everything, this is the store for you. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. And what I also love is that they give back. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. And they've already donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/detective. That's uncommongoods.com/detective for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. What do you think in this case? We'll just call it right up.
So my call would have been homicide.
Interesting. Okay. And I obviously know this, but why? Why? Because okay. I thought that was to me, because I mean, listen, for the people who are, that are not Ivy League doctors, right?
Okay, yes.
I'm going through all the evidence and we're going back and forth on the boy, on the fiance and all the circumstances surrounding it. The fact that the balcony had no footprints
That's
on
right.
it. So we don't really necessarily have any evidence of a third party intruder. That's right. You think about this being a homicide or a suicide, you start to look at those factors. And to me, it comes down to, and this is what we said on the phone, the neck injuries.
Sure.
And not only the amount of neck injuries, but some of what you talked about as far as the depth. And then you went into why. And to me, that was where I said, okay,
so
I'm there.
And I think once I go through it, you'll hopefully see my logic when I approach a complicated case.
I think it's
case.
Very pragmatic.
Yeah, I am pretty practical, pretty logical. And I don't, like, let's say I didn't. If I couldn't sort it out in my mind this way, I would have called it undetermined.
Right.
Okay.
Which so, that's what's interesting to me is you're not even saying, Derek, I would have went undetermined. You're saying, no, I feel
I think
confident.
It's a homicide.
That's compelling
but
to me.
To me, the other thing that is weird is that it's been called suicide twice. They didn't, they didn't waver and say there's other factors that, you know, when I tally it up on suicide versus homicide, I'm sort of getting even amounts. And that's when you would undetermine would be the right choice.
I think a lot more people would be okay with
that's
that.
Right.
The public opinion.
The public opinion, at least undetermined. And you know, during the legal process, which I only learned about that they went through, the parents, I think they were happy when it was changed from suicide to undetermined. Years into the
more
legal
resources
processes.
Can be allotted to
that's
it. This
right.
is technically a closed case now.
Right.
So the amount of services and resources that can be provided by the agencies, slim to none.
But undetermined, you can still investigate.
That would be the way to go.
Right.
But when they say it's a suicide,
then it's
a done
case
deal.
Closed.
They're moving on.
And especially since the courts reopened it for the reevaluation, yeah. and then
people were very hopeful that at least minimum undetermined.
Right. Now, you know, I am playing armchair quarterback where my career is not on the line.
Well, that's the thing, right? And that's where a lot of people feel like this second ruling outside influences played a factor. Like we can't even, and as a pathologist, you can speak to this because maybe you've had it happen. Maybe you haven't, maybe you don't want to speak about it. But from what we understand with Dr. Osborne, he originally thought it was a homicide. He ruled it a homicide. He came out and publicly said it was a homicide. And if we're to believe what's being reported, officers and other public figures came into the equation. There was a lot of pressure. And ultimately, he changed his mind based on another pathologist who said, you know, it was this reason that basically with that injury, she still could have stabbed herself.
Which I don't agree with. That's where's my fundamental difference. And we'll get into that.
We're going to get into that. And so he changed his ruling. And so people were thinking, okay, you have Dr. Simon come in. Maybe she's going to see it differently. Maybe, you know, she'll revisit it. But if agents were coming in during Dr. Osborne's time and got him to change his opinion, is it possible? Is it reasonable to assume that maybe that happened here? And without knowing the inner workings,
I
can't dispute that and say, no, 100%
right,
that didn't
exactly.
happen. Especially when it sounds like it happened the first time.
Right. I don't know the structure of the office. I don't know the structure of the government there.
The politics.
And,
yeah, there's a
and,
lot of
and
things.
And I've been gone from Philly now for 20 years.
Yep. And you're here to talk about the medical stuff.
Right.
We're not even going to talk about Sam's connections.
That's right. So when I read the report, I was wondering, you know, how do I approach any case? So when I'm consulted on a legal case, it's the same sort of methodology that I used here. Okay. Like, what do you think of this, Dr. Banerjee? I got my phone blew up, you know, different outlets, court TV, whatever. What do you think? And so I approach it the same way. Okay, here's the file, 32 pages of this is the only information I'm going to get, right? But I jump to the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't care what five other doctors, I actually didn't remember what they all said, you know, because to me,
there was one biomechanical engineer who said it was possible.
Okay.
It's possible. She stabbed herself in that way, but that wasn't a pathologist.
Yeah, so to me, I didn't even remember what they said. Do you
Which
understand?
Is good.
Because to me, that's not how I
didn't
approach any
you.
Case. No. And I was like, oh, I remember the names. I was like, oh, okay. They're not even like alive, unfortunately, to give their opinion, you know, to chime in how they got to their
Sirleck
decisions.
Sirleck was 2012. He gave his opinion.
I would have loved to have picked their brains as to whether they agree with me or not. Yep. But so you're just going to hear my side of the story. So, yeah, I mean, I just look at the autopsy and say, what do we know? And then I went back and read some of the supporting investigation. But to me, I'm not an expert in blood spatter. I know of it. I've been to plenty of crime scenes. I can tell a drip from a smear. But I'm not getting into the heights and the calculations. I'm not an expert in locks or hinges. So whether the hinge was broken or not, I'm like, I saw a photo of it. But I'm not, that's not going to impact the medicine.
Right.
Okay, so the autopsy and the toxicology, yes, there's, I mean, I like to know that there's no footprints in the snow because at least I know there's no intruder that way. Okay, so that is important.
Yep.
I look at, like, we have winters here, right?
We're trying to figure out who it is.
Right, and we've practiced in winter. We live in New England.
Mm-hmm.
So the snow, I've had suicides in the snow where the footprints went in and never came out. That's actually really important. Mm-hmm. So snow is, I actually have a teaching slide on that, you know, where you look at the track marks and you're like, oh, they came through the trees and they went into that bush and there
snow,
it is.
Snow can be your best friend in an investigation.
And
sure.
So I wanted to know that detail, but am I going to make a ruling just on that? Absolutely not. So let's just jump forward what I think is significant. I do like getting medical history on someone, okay? Where, like, what's going on, right? Okay, she's a teacher. She's very productive, right? She's an educated young woman giving back to her community. She has stressors in her life. She has mental health problems. Great. I didn't sleep for 4 days after having my baby because all I know is deceased children. So to say, you know, anxiety can affect anybody, right? There's no logic to it. She dealt with children, teaching. It's so important. Your wife is a teacher. We were just talking about that, how much you're impacting other people's children. Grades are due. I've taught college and grad school where I'm like, oh, grades are due. You know, that is a hard job. She was getting married. So there's also
stresses
with that, putting that together. I think all of that seemed very normal to me, you know, in that stage of life. And so
we all have stressors,
right. Yeah. And so to ask for help or get mental health, I don't think that automatically rules it a suicide. Do I want to know that? Of course. You know, I think it could be, but that doesn't mean A equals B for me. You know, it's just part of her health history and what's going on with her. You know, they lived in the apartment, et cetera. I take all that into consideration.
How about the fact that she was seeing a psychiatrist?
I think that's fine.
That's fine. And the medications she was on.
Yes. So the medications are really important. So I get those records whenever possible because I want to run toxicology.
Yep.
If someone is suicidal and they have prescribed medicines, I've literally seen people like guzzle their prescriptions. Yeah. When they want to kill themselves, it's an excess. And in her case, it was not. It was being taken.
Subtherapeutic, I think they said.
Yeah, subtherapeutic to therapeutic. It was not alarming at all. And I mean, the thing is she's also lost blood. So you have to be careful with the measurements, but it was nothing sky high to say, oh, she intentionally overdosed on sleeping medication or anxiety medication. You know, like you can't go there.
I saw some reports and I can't even remember where it was from, but there was some conversations about the mixture of both the Ambien and Klonopin that it could cause some temporary psychosis. That might be out your scope.
I don't know about that. So the way I think about it is they're both in that like sedative category. Yeah. So that could make her sleepy. But I think if she was using it regularly as prescribed, which is what the blood levels were, you shouldn't have adverse reactions.
In the middle of the day.
Right. Yeah. I think if there were the levels, I mean, I would be, if I was a pathologist on this case, the toxicology would be the first thing I'm going for, right? Yep. How much is in there? Because if she's suicidal, is she taking
the roof?
Right. Then that really helps me.
Maybe you feel differently. Maybe you say she was on so much medication, she could have had an episode.
That's right. But, I mean, when people want to kill themselves, sometimes they use different modalities at once, right? I want to numb myself. We call alcohol liquid courage sometimes we see in very high levels of alcohol before a suicide, mixtures of alcohol and medication or excess prescribed medication. So I'm not even saying drugs like street drugs. I'm saying prescribed medication. Yep. So, I mean, I've even had elderly folks take a bowl, mix all their medications together and eat it with a spoon. And that's like blood pressure medicines. That's not even the stuff that we think about as typical overdose, you know, but it's all significant, you know? And so to me, the fact that it wasn't sky high makes me take a step back from suicide because she could have killed herself easily or been loopier, you know, by taking excess medicine.
I don't want to be crass. I think I even said it in my first part one of this. She's got a balcony. She's six stories up.
Sure. That could have been an easy escape.
You know, I don't want to be insensitive here.
Right.
But if you really want to make it quick and painless, you jump off your balcony.
Right.
It's over.
And I think I would have probably taken my anti-anxiety medicines and maybe some alcohol.
Full of medication to,
alcohol,
like you said, that liquid courage and then you build up to it. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
And so, you know, there's other ways that would have, where the toxicology would have been more convincing to me.
But like you said, subtherapeutic.
It's subtherapeutic therapy. It's not, nothing is alarming.
Right.
And there's nothing extra, meaning there's no other medication over the counter, no Benadryl, no nothing else that she had access to that was sky high. So there was no mixing of medications. It's just what she was prescribed.
Right.
So that is then less of an issue. So let's look at the wounds because that's really where the money is in this case and how I came so definitively to say homicide. Initially, when I was just learning about this case, even before the report, I think I was listening to a podcast, but it wasn't as medically oriented. So they were talking about more the circumstances and the people and the you know, but it wasn't satisfying to me because I want to know what the autopsy showed. And so looking at this, there's the 20 wounds. There are very complex diagrams. I am not an artist. Other people have rendered them. But over the week, I've been shown diagrams that show the wounds. Now, when we do an autopsy and there's numerous wounds, we just start labeling them. And I like to teach. So I think it's important to say that we don't know anything about the order of the wounds other than the last one because it has a knife sticking out.
That's right.
Okay. And if the knife wasn't there, I couldn't even say that that was the last wound. Okay. So when I'm getting cases that are stab wounds and there's multiple all over the body, if there's one, I know it's only one, right? Yeah. It's the first and last. But if there's more than one, I cannot tell you the order. And so only if the weapon is still lodged in the body, which I've only had a few times in my career, then I can tell you, okay, that's the last weapon or the last wound, and that's what she has here. This is the weapon. We can say definitively. That's all we can say from her autopsy in terms of the order of the wounds, okay? I cannot tell you anything else based on findings, okay? We can get into speculation after this, okay? Yeah. But the out of the lettered wounds, okay, so we usually use A, B, C, D, because I think it's even more misleading to say 1, 2, 3. But the A is just arbitrary. Like, all of the lettering is arbitrary. Like, I always start head to toe on the front, right before left, and then I turn the body over and do head to toe on the back, back, right, back. So I have a very systematic way of doing it. Anyways, there's two wounds, N and T, okay? And I don't recall which one is to the neck and which one's to the base of the head.
N is 8 centimeters penetrated the cerebellum.
Okay, that's the cerebellum
and
one.
And then T is the, those are the two you're referring to on the phone.
Yes.
And T is 7 centimeters. It perforated the neck muscles and spine between the second and third vertebrae.
That's right. Okay, so T is lower. So it makes sense. Yep. So these are two deep wounds. So I don't know why they use centimeters. I usually use inches, but just to translate
I would have
that,
liked it.
Just to translate it, it's 2.5 centimeters per inch. So you have, what, like a 2-inch and between
inch.
2 and 2 and 3 inches,
yep.
right? So these are deep. This
deep.
Is like not an insignificant depth.
Not a lot of muscle.
And she's very thin, right?
Yes.
So you have to think about the fact that you're quickly getting to vital structures, especially in the back, right? The neck.
Not a lot of protection there.
Right. You have some hair, but you don't have a lot of other tissue to get to. So you're going to get into her, like through the skull to the base of the brain. The cerebellum is there. And then the spinal cord is not that deep either, you know, so 3 by 2.5 inches, 3 inches, you're there. So it's a sharp knife, okay, because both times you're going through bone or in between bones to get there. And let's start with N. So N is at the base of the skull. It's gone through all the soft tissues, through the skull or the base of the skull space, and it hits the cerebellum. And that is the region of the brain that helps us with balance and motion, okay? There was bleeding associated with this wound over the brain. And I don't think it takes a lot of education to know the brain doesn't like bleeding over it, okay? It's not, it's a very irritant thing for the brain. So the brain is full of electrical signals. There's normal fluid around it, clear fluid, non-bloody fluid. And as soon as it has bleeding, that's basically almost like a stroke, you know, that you have this whole area of damage that it basically short circuits the brain and lots of chemical reactions happening. There's physical damage, right? When there's bleeding, the knife is hitting the brain tissue. And brain tissue, for those that haven't held a fresh brain, is like firm custard. So it's not this, the skull is hard, right? It's the box around the brain, but the brain, once penetrated by a sharp instrument, is not going to be resistant to it. Very easily damaged, very irritated. The messages are going to be messed up. And what does that mean? So this motion balance, her motion and balance are going to be affected by this injury. Okay? So that's the more, the injury more upper
that's
towards
the higher
her head, the higher one, right?
Yeah.
And then the one that's a little bit lower, so I'm going to use my neck. So at the base of the skull is where our cervical spine starts. So right, the skull sits right attached to the spinal column. And what that allows us normally, right, the way the column is designed is for us to have normal movement, right? We can go round and round, side to side, up and down. So there is movement of the vertebrae, okay? But during this time, it's we call the vertebrae or the bones that make up the neck. And they each have, I'm doing this with my hands because there's a canal. And the spinal cord is protected throughout by this bony cage all the way from our base of our skull all the way down to our pelvis or behind that, okay? And so we use these letters, so cervical meaning neck region, and then we get into thoracic and lumbar. But so that's how we describe where in the body we are. And neurologists use these too because they sort of know where in the body the nerves are coming out. Each region of the spinal cord has nerves that supply the body, and then they also get sensations back. So there's motor that allows movement and sensory that allows information to and from the brain and the periphery. So what's happening is in the cervical spine, the number one is at right at the base of the brain. That allows a lot of this movement. It's a very tight juncture, right? Because you don't want your head, you don't want a bobblehead.
Yep.
Okay.
And you're seeing this on the phone. The vertebrae starts number one at the top
and
goes
then
down.
Right around here at the lowest point it's 7. So we're working our way down as we get towards our shoulders, okay? So with regards to Ellen, C2 and C3 is quite high. You know, in the array, I mean, these vertebrae are only so, you know, depending on how tall you are, they're not massive like a giraffe where they're, and I say that because giraffe have 7 vertebrae, but think about their necks versus ours. These are small spaces and they're designed, and we have discs, okay? So there's like cushiony discs between the vertebrae that also give us padding and allow for our neck to be comfortable. But in between spaces on the sides, we have nerves coming out, okay? And nerves coming in and out. So the spinal cord and the brain are communicating. And then the nerves go to our hands and arms that allow us to move. The neck stab wound was described as entering through the spinal, between those vertebrae, the covering over the spinal cord, and then the spinal cord was seen as bulging. Now, there's some descriptor issues in, it's a little vague in the report, I will say.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy with that because I'm like, how can it be vague? It is or it isn't. But there was at least one doctor that described it as being displaced and bulging. Okay, and I will tell you, I don't want bulging of my spinal cord.
Yeah.
That means the injury went in and at least disrupted the spinal cord from its normal place. And now it's pushing through, bulging, pushing through this new gap, okay, this new wound. And if you think about the way the spinal cord works, if it gets dinged, pushed, smushed, whatever happens to it, it's going to stop messaging. Okay, all these, it's very sensitive. That's why we have a bony cage around it, right? The vertebral bodies. And we're going to stop having signals to and from. So when we're high up, C2, C3, everything, and that's disrupted, that breaks the communication. Now, everything below is not going to work. So the way this happens, it's basically quadriplegia. When you say someone's quadriplegic, you can hear they might have a C5, C6. And as you get higher, there's actually a more risk of sudden death. Like if you have a C1, C2 spinal cord injury, you may not even survive that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because we're getting to such sensitive basic functions in the body, like breathing, heart rate. But as you go lower, it's potentially quadriplegia. So to me, the way I was looking at it is like, well, this spinal cord is dislodged. Like it's unhappy. It's bulging. It's injured. Okay, it's at least shocked from the stabbing.
Mm-hmm.
And she can be thin and the sharp knife can be sharp, but there's still force applied when stabbing someone and getting that injury. Okay, 2.5, 3 inches, even 2 inches, let's say. That's quite a bit of depth into the back of the neck. And so that takes
about
force.
3 inches.
Is a lot, is a lot.
We're looking at about that much.
That's
into
right.
The back of your neck.
That's how you get to the spinal cord, you know, right?
Doesn't you say you hear the number 3 and you're like, oh, that's not that.
But think about how thin she was.
Yeah.
And how delicate all the structures are. We don't have a ton of muscle and soft tissue in the back of her. She had hardly any.
Yep.
So you're going to get to that target area, you know, even a quarter inch, half inch quicker, if you will. So to me, once you have this breakdown of information from the spinal column at C2, C3, nothing else below it works. That's the quadriplegia, okay? Meaning I'm not going to get any signals to my arms and legs. Okay, so that's paralyzed.
And
you
had said C5, C6, C7,
even some of C8 go into your arms. Yeah, so
you gave an analogy on the phone, which I thought was great for sports people out there with football.
Oh, I love football.
You get the high neck injury, right, and you see the football player or whatever on the ground. Unfortunately, they can't move their arms and legs.
Correct.
It's not necessarily because they injured C5, C6. It could be something above it.
Above it.
But it shuts it down.
That's right.
I was like,
so
okay, yeah,
if
I
you have like
that.
A shock, a spinal shock, you'll see it, right? You'll have a hit. You'll have spinal shock. And we're worried that they're paralyzed, right? We get they get on the stretcher immediately with they call them C-spine precautions. C-spine, your cervical spine, you put in a collar so that doesn't move and cause more injury. And then they take them immediately to the neurologist, right? And they get put, the football players, they get put in a hospital, they get treatment. And then they'll say, oh, tomorrow his arms and legs are working again. Thank God, you know? And it's because that spinal cord had such a shock to it, almost concussion, that the messages stop flowing. So to me, even without true dislodging or true disruption, you're still having like the signals aren't working when you have a hit. So think about a stab wound where the spinal cord is bulging. That it's an unhappy spinal cord.
That's not going to be in good shape.
Shape, right.
Yeah, it's not going
to
work out.
And
well.
So to me, that was the biggest red flag, that she has two critical injuries, one to the base of the brain, one to the spinal cord, upper spinal cord, excuse me, that to me are going to render her unable to stab herself after she sustained those wounds. Now,
right.
I cannot say if that was the first wound or the 19th wound, because we know the 20th was
the neck
or brain, base of brain. But yep. We know the 20th was the chest.
But even if it was the 19th.
Right. You can't stab yourself. That to me, physiologically, like when I'm looking at the anatomy, the autopsy, and thinking about how that impacts her, is why I said homicide.
I mean, it made total sense to me when you said it. To put it in layman's terms, essentially, we know the last stab wound was the knife.
That's right.
In the chest. And after she stabbed herself in the neck, at least those two wounds,
right.
She would have been physically incapable of stabbing right. herself in the chest. And there's some other things I want to talk about that may even back up even more so that this could have been something else. But other than injuries NNT, how would you explain the more superficial, as they're described, wounds, not only to the abdomen, but around the neck, around the chest, where you have, I believe, 10 and 10,
uh-huh.
and it seems like they're hesitation wounds or whatever. Maybe, I mean, what would you,
they're
in your
just
experience?
More superficial. I think hesitation, when I've seen it, I haven't seen it as much as stabs as I have like more like lines, like people test the sharpness
like
of the
cuts.
Cuts, yes, in different areas of the body. I've seen it on the neck even. So, I mean, it's not just wrists or arms. Like, people will cut themselves, you mm-hmm. know, on the neck and pretty effectively, I hate to say it. But, you know, maybe there are some superficial wounds. That doesn't sway me either way
right.
in the sense, I mean, if they're very typical, okay, then I would have said, that's, you know, something in the suicide bucket. But the fact that she doesn't have any defensive wounds also is a little weird.
It would line up with being stabbed in the back, wouldn't it?
Well,
to me, that
right.
supports
so
it more.
There's two speculations I can say, okay? One interpretation is it's a suicide, and I think that's what the report relied Fair. On heavily.
Got
so
it.
When we talk about defensive wounds, they're basically slashing wounds. Like, if you're coming at me with a knife, I'm going to say, hey, don't stab me. I'm going to protect my face, my neck, my body, wherever you're trying to hurt me. It's a natural defense, okay? It's not karate training. It's not martial arts training. It's not military training. It's just a natural defense.
Natural instinct.
Yes. And so you can often see the knife's going to hit or the sharp object's going to hit the hands or the arms because they're in the way first, okay?
Right.
And we interpret those as sharp force injuries consistent with defensive wounds, okay? Because we can tell that the person was fighting back. Ellen didn't have those. And it's not because the toxicology was throwing her off, okay? We've already ruled that out. Now I think is, well, either it could be suicide, or what if she had one of these sort of paralyzing wounds earlier in the mix?
Yeah.
You know, if she's incapacitated from the back and then further attacked.
That's it. She's not going to be able to turn around
and
defend herself.
She's not going to be able to defend herself.
And even though it's natural instinct, if you can't physically use your arms and legs,
right.
you're not going to use
them. Motor, your motor, the nerves aren't going to work.
Right.
Right? So this movement's not going to happen. So
to me
is the other explanation of it.
And that's basically, it's a coin flip, right? You got to support the evidence, but then you consider the fact that it appears she was cutting up some fruit or something right beforehand.
That's right.
Which would have left her with her face facing the sink or the counters.
Correct.
Not behind her. And to support what you said there, if she's not looking at this person and they stab her in the neck, well, by the time she realizes what happens, it's too late.
It's too late.
She's not going to be able to, there's going to be no defensive wounds. All right, we're going to take one last break from the interview. Look, fall gets crazy fast between work, family, and everything else. The last thing I want to do at the end of the day is spend hours cleaning. Who wants to do that, right? And that's where HomeAglow, the game-changing cleaning service, comes in. This episode is sponsored by HomeAglow, the top-rated home service platform dedicated to making your space clean and tidy, and it's super easy to use. They have online booking capabilities that allow you to instantly schedule a cleaner in your area for a special occasion, party, or just on a regular basis to take something off your plate. You can get access to trusted cleaners in your area, and you can actually see their reviews and profiles before you book, which, as I always tell you guys, you got to be safe out there. And this is important if you're going to be bringing someone into your home. And cleaners must pass a rigorous certification process, plus maintain a 4.8 star average platform rating. And the best part, 100% of the cleaning fees and tips go directly to the cleaner. You're supporting real people in your community, not some giant corporation. So here's how it works. To schedule a cleaning, you simply go to HomeAglow's website to choose the day and time you're looking for and the duration of your cleaning to match with the cleaner. And from there, they can schedule something as quick as that week or get something on the calendar for next month so you can check it off your to-do list early. And if you really want to make your life easier, you have to check out their Forever Clean membership, which saves you $30 an hour on all future cleanings. So essentially, you can book unlimited cleanings starting at $19 an hour, backed by HomeAglow's happiness guarantee. So take cleaning off your plate this fall by using HomeAglow. Head over to homeaglow.com/detective to get your first 3 hours of cleaning for only $19. That's HomeAglow.com/detective. I want to talk about a couple other injuries that were mentioned in the autopsy report. Some of them you may say it's a nothing burger, it's not relevant, but I wanted to bring it up. We have the incised wound on the head, the gash on the head. You think about all the other wounds, that to me could be some sign of an altercation.
Sure.
What was your interpretation of that?
I mean, I just look at it as a wound. You know, I think, I try not to over-
Relative to a suicide though.
Oh, that's true.
You get what I'm saying? Like, yeah, is that something you'd smack yourself in the head with a sharp object before you stab yourself 20 times?
Yeah, usually not.
Yeah, it's to me, it just seemed a little...
It would be a little bit atypical.
It didn't fit the other wounds
other patterns, right.
So that was one thing. And then we also had... I could go either way with this one. I'm not a doctor, but the 30-ish contusions,
yeah,
the bruises.
Yeah, so this is where I'm cautious. So, you know, I've said a lot of things and I've explained a lot of things, but I'm actually on the cautious side, okay? Unless I can definitively back it up with science, with medicine, I don't make a conclusion, okay?
Right.
Now, I know the literature says, and this comes up in other cases, especially child abuse, where the people are looking at bruising and the color and trying to overinterpret it. And so the medicine, the pathology behind this really stems from child abuse cases, if you will. So when I have a death and I'm trying to date a bruise, I would look at it under the microscope, okay? And the papers say that just by visually looking at something and the location and color does not allow you to date it. Okay, maybe some yellowing would say it's slightly older, but we're different people. We're of different complexions, different genetics. We're on different medicines, maybe, you know, allergies, whatever it is, right? You can hit me with a hammer. I can hit you with a hammer at time zero, but we might heal differently. Do you understand? We're going to have the same impact, same force, but it's just how we're different. Okay, the other thing is, if you think about it, I've had bruises on my shin. I've had bruises on my thigh, and I'm like, the bruises on the thigh look very different than my shin, which has no tissue on top, right? It's a hard bone, which hits immediately, versus my thigh can take a lot more impact. And so even on different regions of the body, it can look different, okay? And so you want to be very cautious with over-interpreting wounds. I don't like to say that those all happened at once or some are older, saying that she's chronically abused. I think that's way a misinterpretation, okay? We also have to think about we're seeing her at one timestamp, right? Like after she dies at autopsy. But she could have had all those bruises before, days before, that morning of. Like because I'm just seeing her at once doesn't mean they all occurred at the same time with the stab wounds or with the sharp force injuries, okay?
Yeah, they were saying they could be different times.
Or they could have all happened at the same time. You just can't, the color, the size, the locations, they can be suggestive sometimes of grabs and stuff, but you can't really determine that. And the appearance, it's actually improper science to interpret any bruise based on the color. So usually it's done at autopsy and you look at it under the microscope, but you can't even date something under the microscope accurately, like as few as 18 hours. Like you're not getting the 1 to 2 hour range, you know? So to say that you can visually or under the microscope really tease it apart is—
You can just tell it's a little bit older of a bruise.
That's right, because you have the body's had time to react. Now, if you don't survive that injury for 18 hours, you're not going to have a reaction.
Right.
And then you can't time it. Do you understand that?
So they're at least older than that.
Right. You're at least, like, the earliest you can time a bruise based on the literature is 18 hours, maybe, you know, but earlier than that,
You can't. I mean, people have looked at it different ways. Some people say it's evidence of some type of previous abuse.
Yes.
I could also see a world where she was still killed by someone else, but these bruises are contributed to her being a first grade teacher.
First grade teacher being
so
grabbed
I think the
right.
two can still be true.
That's
where
right.
It's like it could still be a homicide, yet these bruises are not relevant to the case. But if you're going along the lines of her fiance being involved, you would think there might be some previous signs of abuse in the relationship, which is what else I wanted to bring up with you, because in the initial report, and I'm going to butcher this, so feel free to correct me, there were two discrete areas of hemorrhage in the right sternothyroid muscle at the level of the thyroid gland, which were not described in the original report. What's your interpretation of that?
Yeah, that is worrisome because that is So when we look at the neck, okay, yeah. I like to tell people, like, when I turn my neck, you can sort of see a muscle, right? This is the thickest muscle we have, the sides of our neck.
And it's called the strap muscle?
Is Everything in the neck are called strap muscles. And they're layers of muscles that are straps of muscle that connect from underneath our chin all the way to bones and structures within the neck, okay? So this is the sternocleidomastoid, that thick sort of turny muscle that you can feel on the side. And then deep to that, there's different layers. And then we have our voice box, like our cartilage, which is the thyroid cartilage. The thyroid gland sits on this.
Yep.
So between the thyroid and the sternum, this strap muscle goes. And there's two areas of bleeding. Now, that's very concerning.
Why?
So when I'm doing what's called a forensic neck exam, anytime I'm trying to get a really good look at the neck for injury, which in any homicide I'm doing, okay? But my threshold is very low. Some people do it on every case. I mean, I always look at the neck, but this is a very layer by layer examination. Mm-hmm. And so we peel back each layer to look for bleeding within those structures. And if there's any bleeding, that needs to be explained because, I mean, you can have like injection, like if you have a IV in your neck or you go and have a biopsy of your thyroid gland, yeah, you're going to have bleeding there.
Right.
Right. But if someone dies, I want to know, oh, they had a biopsy of their thyroid gland. That's why there's bleeding there. You know, usually if there's any kind of pressure put on the neck, a strangulation, injury, that's when we see the bleeding in those muscles, if it's not like otherwise explained. So that would be concerning as well. And how that was left out is
the problem.
Inexplicable to me. And this is very, when I say very concerning, this goes again towards the homicide side of things.
Yeah. Well, there was no petechial hemorrhaging. There was no injury to the hyoid bone or the larynx. But if you were to see this, let's say it's not Ellen. You're doing an autopsy, young girl.
I don't like it at all.
And you start to do your examination. You find this exact type of injury. What's your initial thought?
I don't want to curse on video, but.
You feel free.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit. Meaning what?
This is really bad. This is unexplained injury that should not be here.
And what would be an explanation for something? What would cause that?
We need to figure that out, you know?
Strangulation, like, possibly?
Strangulation, yeah. That's the number 1, 2, 3 thing that I'm thinking about. Now, in hangings, let's just play devil's advocate for suicide.
That's what I want to do here because there's no sign of a hanging because that's what I was initially thinking.
Right, so hangings
A failed attempt?
Right. Sometimes hangings, you can see a little bit of bleeding in the strap muscles right where the biggest pressure point is, like from a rope or ligature. But that's not here in this case.
Yeah. And no ligature marks.
No ligature marks. So, you know, so now what? Now what are we doing?
It's internal, which
is, and it's deep. So like if I'm laying on something, okay, maybe I'll get something superficially on this thick muscle, but this is layers in. Do you understand? This is like, so this is closer to the thyroid gland. We need to see why this is there. This would be, to me, as a finding of homicide as well. I don't have any alternate explanation. Her being face down on a kitchen counter or, you know, struggling and then falling back or whatever happened in the kitchen, none of it.
If you look at the photo, she's facing up. She's facing up.
So there's not even pressure on the neck.
She didn't fall in a certain way broomstick or something underneath her neck.
Being wedged in there or something.
I went back and looked.
Because, like, did she fall into the sink and have her neck, like, sort of hang over where there would be pressure on the neck? None of that seemed to apply here. So that, to me, is very, very concerning.
You have that. And then the other thing I saw was part of what law enforcement's hanging their hat on, and I wanted you to weigh in on this because you talked about C2, C3, and these injuries specifically, N and T. One pathologist said, listen, there was injury to the spinal cord sheath, but not the spinal cord, which therefore would have caused a side effect of being completely numb, where you could have stabbed yourself and not felt that pain.
I don't believe that. I think that is, that's like splitting hairs to me.
That's what they're hanging their hat on.
But the football analogy is exactly when I inserted it in our conversation.
It's all or nothing.
Right. Well, which is like, you're stabbing. This is not a poke.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a stab into the, and it cutting through the sheath, which is the protective
lining. Which, by the way, how thick would the sheath be?
Sheath is just a few millimeters, you know, but it's still getting deep.
What is the likelihood that you would penetrate that deep, but not hit the spinal cord, but the sheath? How close is the sheath?
I mean, it's overlying it. Right.
I mean, and so, it's like electrical wire. It's the same thing.
That's right. It's like the covering of the electrical wire.
Try cutting the covering without the wire if you're not a professional. And by the way, not going slow, stabbing into it.
Right.
And so, doing that. Good luck with that.
And so to me, that's where the I am a football fanatic. So
I'm with you. Who you're a fan of?
Oh
though?
My God. Are you going to put this on air? I'm the Ravens fan, of
oh
course.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I need tickets.
Interview over.
If someone's watching this from the Ravens, I'm in New England being a Ravens fan. I need tickets.
Go Pats.
But, you know, we've seen it time and time again on the field, unfortunately, where even the shock of like, right, an impact. They don't fracture the vertebrae. They don't disrupt the sheath, right, when they get an injury on the field. And the spinal cord's not working. And so to me, I think that's exactly when I brought it up, is like the message is, why would half the cord not work? And it's usually at a level. You know, it's like when the message is short circuit and don't get through, it's basically the whole spot. I mean, it's not like one corner and or one edge and not the other edge. I just don't see neurology working that way. Like the brain short circuits, the spinal cord short circuits. There's so much intercommunication and we don't see it, but you see like when they map it out in neurology, there's fibers going this way, this way, this way. It's not just like a straw, you know? There's so much going up and down and side to side. To say that it's that she would only have numbness seems very arbitrary.
And how would she know that would be the, like, I mean, was that the plan? What would be the intention for me? Just thinking about it from like, just as a lay perspective, yeah. I want to kill myself. At no point am I going to think, hey, based on everything I know, the efficient way to do this is to reach behind my head and stab myself in the neck. Like,
well, I mean, even knowing what I know, if I had to stab, I don't know that I would be able to get exactly to where I need to go.
There's so many. The chest. Okay, I'm with you. Sure. There, but all the other stuff, it would go back to some type of psychotic episode, which we've already ruled that out because she was fine before Sam left.
That's right.
And so something happened within that small window while he was gone. And we haven't even talked about, which is another question I think the audience might have, was as a pathologist, yeah, you're letting the body tell a story, but you are considering outside factors that the detective will bring to
absolutely.
You.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we've only talked about Ellen's body. We haven't talked about the fact that on that 911 call, have you heard it?
I have not.
So he's listening to this 911 call. Have you seen the photos of the knife?
No.
So the knife, maybe so she's got passing. Like a fleece type sweatshirt that zips up. And the knife is sticking out of the jacket.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
We saw how she was found. She's facing chest up. And on this 911 call, he's like, oh, I don't know what happened to her. She's got some blood from her head. And it's not until the dispatcher says, oh, you need to perform CPR. And he's like, oh, I can't get the zip. Oh, wait, she has a knife sticking out of her chest. And if you see the photo, there's no way you missed this.
It's very blatant.
But the way I was trying to describe it in part one, where it's like, oh, even if it was underneath the sweatshirt, you would still see it like a tent. Uh-huh. But
she's very thin.
But you can see the handle sticking out clearly. And that's a factor for me. There's other factors that about this other than what you've talked about with the body. That's more of the investigatory process where, to me, couple that with your findings or your opinions, I just don't know how they're convinced enough to say suicide and not undetermined.
That's
minimum.
Right. Minimum. And that's, I mean, you know, there are factors. I'm not trying to be so inflammatory that it has to be homicide. I do feel strongly that the anatomic findings really pushed me over. But undetermined, I would never in my career, my professional opinion, rule this a suicide. I would go undetermined. Now, if all the investigation came back, let's say for devil's advocate, and it was still a suicide, fine.
Okay.
You're not going to get me to change the death certificate. You can put in your files suicide. You know, but for me, I will still sign it as undetermined.
My big gripe with this case, and it kind of goes to what you just said, is if they went in there and because of the circumstances with the, you know, I know they couldn't see all the injuries because of her hair and stuff at the time, but if you initially rule it or treat it as a homicide, you're going to have crime scene technicians there. You're going to seize all the evidence. We're going to allow, as you described it, data points to be provided to you to allow you to make a better assessment of it.
But
because they ruled it a suicide initially, very little was done, including obtaining her laptops and cell phone initially. So that you can't go back and do that now.
No. And as a doctor who did go to crime scene, so part of my job for Rhode Island was visiting. So if the body's at the scene like Ellen's was, I would go.
Well, Dr. Osborne went out there too, I believe, didn't he? I can't recall.
Right.
I think he went out there. But I could be wrong on
that. To me, that's vital. And what I would at least say is, let's treat this like a homicide and then we'll figure it out. Because there are times when the lighting is bad. It's an apartment where there's lots of blood and you guys need to do your job with collecting evidence. Let's get the body out of here. X-ray her, get her to the morgue where I can take, I have operating room lights to look, you know, and very systematic. But treat this as suspicious. And I legally, this is something I wanted to say, which is unlike TV, I don't have the authority, A, to even enter the house without police presence, even right. though there's a dead body in there, okay? So usually there's a search warrant. So
it's a crime scene. You got to right. sign in.
Right,
you gotta,
search warrant. Yep. Police presence.
You're contaminating the scene as much as anybody else.
Absolutely. And I can't go in willy-nilly with my investigator, take the body and not tell anybody. Yeah. Okay. Then all of the investigation, all of the evidence collection needs to be done. And then we sort of piece it together. But if you don't treat the scene as suspicious and then don't collect the electronic data, I can tell you if there's a knife in the body, which there was, that knife will come with us as evidence, and then we will take it out at autopsy. She will be x-rayed with the knife in place to yep. see where it goes, then very carefully remove it, secure it as evidence so it can be fingerprinted, DNA tested.
And they did leave it in her body till they got
that's
there,
right.
which is, that's good.
That's right. But I don't have any legal authority to go look at a cell phone,
yeah,
a laptop. Even it could be sitting right next to her body, but it doesn't get, I have no say in the matter. And so that is why the investigation of the scene where you can speak of is, and you may need to get a search warrant for that and yeah. all that to dump it, but that's huge.
And they did get the laptop and cell phone after the fact, and who knows
right.
what was done at that point. It's unfortunate. If they would have treated it as a homicide, I think that the pathologist and everybody involved would have had more evidence to go
absolutely.
Off of. And without that, now you're reverse engineering a homicide, potentially a homicide, and it makes it difficult because there's some things you can't recreate. The
absolutely.
Crime scene was already cleaned up within like 24 hours. Before her autopsy, the crime scene was already
I wouldn't have
up.
Released the scene.
I know.
I would have said that someone needs to stay here because depending on what I find on my exam tomorrow, that's yeah. how we have to correlate it.
Yeah.
You know?
One of the most fascinating things to me about this case, though, is the fact that a lot of the times you will have a pathologist say undetermined, right? That's
correct.
What it comes back
yes.
as. This pathologist said homicide.
Yes.
So he was the first guy who got to see her body, who got to examine it, probably the freshest it's going to be. And he says, yeah, looking at this.
And he also went to the scene potentially, right?
Yeah, I believe he did.
Right.
I believe he did. And now at the scene, and I could be wrong on this, I apologize, there's so much information, but I believe he went to the scene and he couldn't see too much at the time and he kind of accepted what they were saying. Yeah, this is a suicide.
Scenes are hard. Like yeah. there's 20 people in this yeah. small room.
I believe he did.
Lighting.
The more and more it's coming back to me,
but
I believe he did.
Even if he didn't, but let's say either way, you know, you're still extracting information from yeah. the scene. You don't make huge decisions at the scene.
Yeah.
Okay. What you're doing is triage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I bag her hands. I take photos of her hands. I'm treating this as a homicide. I don't think that's a stretch at all.
Yeah, they didn't do any of that.
Yeah. But that to me would be the first thing I do, right? Yeah. From an ME perspective. That's why I go to the scene is how do I want to handle the body at a scene? Photograph her hands, leave the knife in place. Put her in a body bag, you know, do as much photography as you can at the scene. Get like rigor, liver, like what are her postmortem changes? Because that's really important in timing. And then let's bag her and get her out of there. So the rest of the scene is not contaminated or smeared or anything.
Yeah.
And let's treat it suspicious. And then what? We've done too much work. Okay.
Better be safe than
right.
sorry. I said it in the previous episode.
That's really all that it comes down to. And sometimes I've definitely had police that are not a fan of mine because yeah. I've said, hold the scene, or this is not clearly a suicide and I don't like this, or, you know, this doesn't sit well with me. We need to hold. And like, you know, I know it's overtime to hold a scene for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there are resources that, and that's a real concern, right? There's only so many people and so much money with resources that have to be spent. But to me, that's how you should treat it to be thorough. Is
yeah.
hold the scene for 24 hours and then I do the case and then we go from there.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think I know the answer to this question as we're kind of wrapping this up. I'm hoping I'm wrong, but two pathologists now have both ruled it a suicide. Is there anything else that can be done?
I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
I'm not a judge.
But nobody else inside that office is going to look at it.
I doubt it. My understanding was there was some court ruling led to sort of this revisiting the
that's
case
right.
in entirety.
We're going to talk about that. That's coming up in
yeah,
our next
that's
part.
Not, this is me stepping out of my,
yeah,
I'm back to lay
part
lay
of
terms
the reason
of
they're doing this is because of the public pressure.
Pressure,
all this stuff,
and
but,
I think the family had a filing, a yeah. court filing. And so there was a ruling by October, some date, 14th, 15th, that needed to be revisited.
Yeah.
And that's when the report was released. To me, I mean, courts probably see it as they did their due diligence. The ME did the full review. I don't see why this
they're
would
not
be
touch it again.
I don't think so.
I think only at this point, maybe you get the U.S. attorney involved and maybe there's something there, but I doubt
don't,
it.
I don't know what channels. I really don't.
Yeah.
I'd be fascinated if there's a lawyer you know, who's it. Watching this show. That
it's hard enough to get them to do this again.
That's right.
To even have this happen was a win, because normally it's the main guy or the main woman and they say, hey, that's it. I'm not, unless there's something else, I'm not changing my decision.
Really, the caveat is when we practice, I reserve the right to review any new information and amend my opinion as needed. Now, I'm not sure there's new information, though.
No.
Right? So they're really revisiting an old case. And so this was, an extenuating circumstance where they were granted permission.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean, really, in my practice, it's until there's something compelling that's, then you can give it to me 20 years later, you know, 15 years later. Okay, I'll look at it. Do you understand? I never discount anything. But I don't think that was the case here, that there was new information. There wasn't. And they didn't really, I mean, my understanding is the apartment building's still there, but it's refurbished and like, it's not, there's no way.
There's no way. Even there was a lot of investigative practices that didn't happen, which make it difficult to go any other way. And I will say this, and it's just my opinion, I could be wrong, but you said something at the top of this episode, which we hadn't talked about before the episode, where you said, in this new report, I just went right to the pathology. And that's interesting to me, because when I read that report, even though it was written by a pathologist, it read like a police officer or a detective.
There was a lot of
investigatory stuff.
Yes, and I don't know if that was regurgitating the reports that were given to them.
Maybe.
But I'm very careful about playing operator.
Well,
you know,
my concern is who else was involved in the writing of this report?
Because that's not the language that we use.
My concern would be, was this an independent analysis done by the pathologist?
I see.
I have nothing to prove that. But when we think about, again, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist guy.
Uh-huh.
But when you think about Dr. Osborne and what happened there, and the fact that it was a homicide and then he changed it to a suicide, depending on who you believe, because of public pressure, or I should say internal pressure, not public pressure. And now you have this other report, which reads like a police report in a lot of ways. You wonder who was involved in the creation of this. It may have been just her.
Right. I don't.
But
I
it's
don't
a question
know.
I have.
Right. I mean, I approach this case like I do every case, which is I look at the I don't read any expert's report. Okay. So I don't care. It was Dr. Weck, who I respected. You know, Dr. Lee.
Yep.
Great. I didn't read the reports. I don't think they're even made public.
Yeah,
you know?
I think they don't even know it was a full report. It was more of an assessment. They took excerpts from their assessments.
I went to the autopsy, toxicology, scene photos, whatever was made available. Then I worked backwards. What is her medical history? You know, correlating that with the toxicology especially. And then I'm like, okay, so what are the circumstances behind it?
Right.
So that's how I work even a consultative case. If I'm the primary pathologist on an autopsy, that's how I always work.
Yeah.
And so all of that, that's just how my brain works, and I'm very systematic with it. So there was a lot of this is what it showed, this is what it showed, you know, differing facts in the event. But that's why I think I really come back to the medicine.
Agreed.
That's what I'm good
that's
at.
What
and
got,
this
that's
is what
solidified
right.
my opinion. And we're going to get to that next episode. But yeah, I was leaning that way. And then when you started explaining it to me, I was like, yeah, this is 1 + 1 = 2. This next step can't happen if this step happens.
That's right.
When you talk about the neck injuries, this chest injury doesn't happen if the injury.
And I encourage people, I don't know if there'll be a head or spine diagram.
Well, there's going to be a couple diagrams up there.
Specifically, the one
that we're talking about where you see all the knife marks. Not only do you see the knife marks, and it's probably up on the screen right now, but you can see the angle and the depth,
because
not every knife is the same. And that's on purpose. They make it so you can see which ones were deeper. And it's when you see that visual, that's the thing everyone sees. You look at that and you say, hey, guess what that's from? A suicide.
That's right.
And everyone's going, what?
Right.
And no shot.
I think looking at the structures and the anatomy and the depth of the wounds, whatever all this fancy language that I use in communication, nerves, motor, sensory, once you look at it, I think, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
I agree.
So they can really put that based on what I said. Okay, she said it went here. Yeah, that's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in this case and a lot of other ones, I always say the absence of evidence doesn't always mean that it's evidence, right? For example, in this case, they're talking a lot about the fact that on the knife handle, there was no DNA from Sam. And that indicates that he never touched the knife. Well, I could make an argument that he cleaned the knife and then rubbed her hand on it. And if he took the proper measures, there may not be. You don't always have DNA on a.
Right.
On
and this is so.
So to say that to me, that doesn't sway me. If this was a staged scene, you wouldn't expect to find. And
correct.
Even if you found his DNA on it.
Well, then we'd say that's a shared kitchen knife because they live in the apartment.
So are you meaning to tell me, and this is a great point, this was a shared kitchen, right? You have to imagine that at some point, Sam touched this knife. The fact that his DNA is not on it is almost more concerning to me because you would expect to find his DNA as well as others on it, and yet you find only her DNA, which to me would potentially indicate that it was cleaned and then touched by her in whatever manner. So
right.
You, whatever way you want to interpret it, you can.
You can, right. So, and this is getting beyond my area of expertise.
Beyond your scope. And we're just talking, but right. These are the things I think about.
And then that's probably where your mind as a detective comes in more, too, is like, I'm trying to really focus. And I take that into consideration, but I'm not going to change my anatomic interpretation based on whether there's DNA on a knife. But to me, you know, this is how I put the pieces of the puzzle together, is how do I sort through all these wounds, which ones are the lethal ones, and then, and in which way? I mean, although there's blood loss from the heart and around, you know, from the chest wound, now there's neurologic compromise from the neck and brain wounds, and now we have this, like, sort of interplay of, uh-oh, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, pretty simple, right? The chest injury doesn't happen if the neck injuries happen. So the fact that we know they happened and there was still blood coming from it, she was still alive when it happened, wasn't after the fact. That's
correct. That's not a post-mortem wound. And I do want to clarify that.
Yeah.
So the way we tell anti-mortem, so when she's physiologically alive, not necessarily conscious, okay? Mm-hmm. We don't have to talk about consciousness, her heartbeat and pumping blood, her heart's
simple.
Yeah. Her body's working still, versus post-mortem when she's physiologically dead. And then if she's stabbed or wounded, then is whether there's bleeding associated with
right.
it.
Right. And there was blood.
There's blood at the cerebellum all the way into the brain surface has blood on it. So the injury bled, even the brain bled. And so that's really important.
Yeah. Well, you got one problem, because now that this was so interesting and so fascinating and you're close by, I'm going to have you come back all the time.
Okay.
Anytime there's a case that involves an autopsy report, we're calling up Priya.
Yep. As long as I'm in town, I'm here.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking the time.
This was nice.
Where can I know you're working privately. Maybe you don't want to. Where can people find you?
Oh, wow. So slowly I'm building a more of a presence, we'll say.
Well, now you're going to be, you know, people hitting you up. Some people agreeing with you, some people
like. I'm sure I'm going to get hate mail. Yeah. That's okay. I'm a
they can send it to the same box they send mine.
So my email is autopsymd@gmail.
Okay.
My company is anchorforensicpathology.com.
We'll have it on the screen as well.
Yeah, Anchor Forensic Pathology. That's my, nod to Rhode Island.
Yep.
And all my information's online.
Yep.
And pretty much, you can find me on Facebook. I have a small following on Facebook now because I was getting so many personal, like.
You got to get an Instagram.
I got to get an Instagram. I need a social media manager. So that's really what I need.
Especially if you're doing all these interviews.
I do.
And all that stuff.
I think this is my sixth or seventh interview this week. So
it's all, you said mostly about Ellen.
It is. So
what's the docuseries? The docuseries comes out, and also this new
what
ruling.
Happened is I was supposed to be on the Hulu one.
Oh, interesting.
I was supposed to be the doctor on it because Sarah, Kayleen, and I work on a cold case team together, but I was in a military court-martial trial in San Diego, and that's actually why I was listening to the podcast, because I was like, I don't know anything about this case. What case am I going to be speaking on Hulu?
Yep.
And for logistical reasons, you can't be in San Diego and Philadelphia at the same time, and so that was no problem, you know. And so I sort of laid it to rest. Do you understand? Like, I was like, oh, I'm not doing the program. Fine, let me go deal with my court-martial. You know, focus on the work at hand, and then full circle. Now I'm like deep into it because. And I think this report, in some sense, at least presented more information to the public.
I agree with that.
You know, it was more holistic.
I do wonder where it came from. But
it was a more holistic, like a much more thorough than even what was available for Hulu.
Yeah. And that's the point, right? Like, there's talks about neighbors who had seen him, Sam, struggling at the door. Now that's coming out. That information is coming out from the pathologist.
Yeah, that doesn't always
make
sense.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
That's concerning to me. That means that she got that information from someone, or it wasn't
right,
disclosed
we're not
to us initially.
We're not interviewing anybody.
Correct. So those are some of the concerns I have, for sure.
But anyways, this was very,
no, this was enlightening.
Very great.
I'm glad you got to hear directly from Priya, because you explain it much better than I ever could.
Well.
I would have taken, I took your notes down and I'm like, oh yeah, no, it's going to be better if it's coming from her.
Oh, that's good.
So weigh in down in the comments below if you're watching on YouTube. Let us know what you think. You know where you can find Priya now, but let us know what you think of all this. You can kind of see where I'm going with this. You guys are part-time detectives. I think you know where I'm going to land on this one, but let us know your thoughts, your comments. We'll get back to some people.
And
maybe
you know,
Priya
and it's
will be
okay
in there.
To disagree with me.
Oh, they will.
And that's
some,
okay, because sometimes I think people, you know, I'm very open-minded.
Yeah.
I want to see the, you know, devil's advocate
yeah.
size. you know, you because, and you know, that's how we prepare for court too, right?
Yeah.
They're always going to question you. And so I have a thick skin and I'm ready to be challenged. So, you know, this is not a straightforward case. I would say this is one of, you know, I think this case, we'll leave it at this, is why I like forensic pathology. People think it's all solved in an hour. It's black and white.
It's how like can the TV
you,
shows.
Right. How can you have, there's a stab wound, you know, oh, 20 stab wounds. How can that be a suicide? Well, I've just told you I had 90 plus stab wound suicide. Yeah. So you can't ever just walk in and make assumptions. You really have to take it in totality.
Yeah. No, it was great. We're definitely going to have you back.
Oh, thank
and
you.
Once, I appreciate you being the first person on the set. The yes. set is like 80% done. It's not where I want it to be. Actually,
well, I'm not technical, so it looks great to me.
Priya got the advantage of seeing me set all this up again beforehand, and yeah. I didn't love it, but finally I was like, all right, we got to go.
Yeah.
But there's a lot I'm going to change. This is just a start, but we'll have Priya back to talk about your background,
sure.
some of your most notorious cases sure. that you've worked that have stuck with you. I got some big plans for 2026, but this case warranted having you come in yeah. and talking directly to the audience.
Thank you.
It comes much better from the horse's mouth. Maybe that's what they should have done in this case.
Yeah,
had the person saying what they were saying say directly to us, and then they wouldn't have to go back and say they didn't say it. But that's a different story for a different day. Guys, we appreciate you being here. Everyone stay safe out there. We'll see you next week for part 3.